And at this point, I'd like to call for announcements from, ready announcements from the attorneys in this morning's case. And this case is 032161 CV, Office of the Attorney General of Texas versus Brickman, Penley, Maxwell, and Vassar. Counsel for the Attorney General, if you'd introduce yourself to the court, please, this morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice Byrne. My name is Jeff Stone. I represent the Office of the Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. Counsel, yes, sir.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Joe Knight. I represent FLE behind Vassar. I represent the argument this morning for all of the FLEs.
And the court is thankful of your accommodation for all four of the appellees. I wasn't certain how you were going to be presenting your argument today. And at this time, we'll hear from Mr. Stone. Mr. Stone, you may take up the podium, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice Byrne, and may it please the court. The Whistleblower Act waives immunity for claims based on reports regarding only public employees, appointed officials, or an employing governmental entity. But the Attorney General, Ken Paxton, is none of these. He is neither an employee, nor an appointed official, nor is he the office of the Attorney General, the employing governmental entity. He's an elected official. Plaintiffs, therefore, have not pleaded a claim within the Act's narrow sovereign immunity waiver. While plaintiffs also raise purpose and policy-based arguments to avoid this result, these arguments are misplaced in the light of the Texas Supreme Court's repeated instruction that waivers of sovereign immunity are to be narrowly construed.
Mr. Stone, you would agree that the OAG is made up of about 700 attorneys?
If generally, yes, Your Honor, and thousands of employees pass that.
And they make decisions every day. The employees do.
Certainly, many of them.
File pleadings.
Absolutely.
Issue open records decisions, et cetera.
All right? Sorts of things.
And the OAG can't act without its employees doing something, right?
Generally speaking, yes.
So isn't the action of every lawyer at the OAG's office an action by the employing governmental agency under Texas Government Code 554-002?
Well, Your Honor, the problem with that argument is that it renders part of 002A superfluous because the Act protects against, quote, a report of a violation of law by the employing governmental entity or another public employee. Public employee, of course, defined to mean employees or appointed officers. So to the extent that the legislature would have understood that employing governmental entity meant everyone working at OAG, that another public employee language would be rendered entirely superfluous. Secondly, if that were the intention of the legislature or with the text the legislature wrote, there's no need to have the modifier appointed before officer. As this court has explained several times, the categories employee on the one hand and officer on the other are mutually exclusive, where employees are individuals who are only entitled to exercise sovereign powers at the direction of a superior, usually the superior being an officer or ultimately leading to an officer, while an officer is entitled to exercise the sorts of sovereign authority, sovereign powers on behalf of the state without further review. So had the legislature anticipated that for an agency, all officers, meaning appointed and otherwise elected officers, would be included, it would have included that modifier appointed before officer.
Are there unpaid appointed officers in the state of Texas?
I believe there are some appointments that are, Your Honor. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but I understand that there are some volunteer boards and so on. Whether or not they qualify as officers in the sense of employee versus officer, given that they're not subject to supervision, likely they qualify as an officer. You'd have to give me a further specific before I can comment before. But I'm happy to say that might be the case.
Stone,
yes, Your Honor.
Is your argument that every elected official is somehow exempted from the Whistleblower Act?
Your Honor, the legislature drew a careful line between the kinds of individuals subject to the Whistleblower Act. To answer your question directly, yes. Elected officials are not included in the definition of employee, appointed official, or employing governmental entity. So all elected officials.
Not just the five constitutional officers.
This particular this clause defining what reports are protected would reach any of your honors, the Texas Supreme Court's justices, the members of the legislature as well.
The commissioner's court, sorry.
Supreme Court justices could sexually harass their chief employee and be immune from anything other than getting in the paper and the voters voting them out of office.
Well, only in the sense of that the Whistleblower Act wouldn't provide them this particular discrete cause of action in court. There are, of course, a variety of other remedies for situations like that. There are other statutes and other potential claims. For example, there are ordinary sort of workplace dispute resolution processes. But
wouldn't you be arguing sovereign immunity again?
It depends, again, different statutes sometimes, especially, for example, ultra vires claims, different statutes have different waivers. I'm particularly pointing to this one because, to answer your question sort of right on the button, no, the Whistleblower Act wouldn't be available in the hypothetical you outline. But I don't want to downplay the importance. I mean, as elected officers, you're all very aware of the importance of having to answer to the voters periodically. The legislature, of course, has supervisory authority over all the other state-created bodies and even the constitutionally created ones, legislative budget oversight, the potential for impeachment and removal, and again, being answerable in the press, ultimately to the voters themselves. These are powerful checks on misconduct by elected officials. The fact that under certain circumstances, there might not also be a judicial remedy for this particular kind of claim doesn't deprive someone who's been wronged by an elected official directly of a variety of potential avenues for relief.
And that includes commissioners' courts, city council, school board, any elected official?
Any elected official, yes, Your Honor, because when it comes to the local side, the local governmental entities are defined also in corporate terms, essentially as political subunits. So again, to the extent that you're dealing with someone who is neither an appointed officer nor an employee nor the entity itself, yes, elected officials would not be subject to the Whistleblower Act's narrow sovereign immunity waiver, which...
Now, could the Attorney General be sued under Government Code 554.008 that says a supervisor who violates the Whistleblower Act can be personally sued?
I believe what that says is that it limits the liability for individual supervisors. I think that the claim has to be brought against the employing entity, but a supervisor who participates in what is ultimately adjudged as a Whistleblower Act claim, nonetheless can be held up for up to a $15,000 civil fine. 2 points. First of all, supervisor isn't defined in the statute, so it'd be an open question as to whether or not an elected official who heads an agency qualifies as a supervisor. I don't take a position on that now, but it certainly isn't precluded by the definitions provided. But I will point out that the second part of 008 particularly supports our argument regarding individual humans not listed, because it provides a limitation on liability right in the act for individual persons up to that $15,000 sanction. The other kinds of sanctions meant to be directed at the employing governmental entity.
Correct, but that implies then even elected officials who are in a supervisory, you know, once we determine who is and who is not a supervisor, but assuming that an elected official is a supervisor, then under 008, they would be able to be personally sued, at least have civil liability up to $15,000. That also, I mean, it implies that they can be sued.
These are two sort of next door neighbor questions, Your Honor. The first question for purposes of the immunity waiver is about whom the report is being made. So if the report is being made about misconduct by, say, the entity itself, the entity has entered into contracts that in fact make false representations to federal law, something on that order, as we've had at least in one case since HHSC, and then as a consequence, a supervisor directly fires someone because of that, that might be a situation where you have a report that's been made by a covered party because it's a report being made about the employing governmental entity. And even though the given supervisor didn't take any part in the alleged wrongdoings given rise to the whistleblower claim, that individual actually committed the termination, and so they're liable for up to that $15,000 sanction. So there could be a circumstance under which someone who is not subject to the about whom a report would not ground the whistleblower's sovereign immunity exception, could be nonetheless liable for that sanction. But again, that's because the immunity waiver which is coterminous for liability on the ultimate claim, is different from this $15,000 sanction for an individual who enacts a firing. So I don't think it follows that the idea that someone might be able to be liable personally for this sort of claim for the, up to $15,000, I don't think that changes the scope of the immunity waiver, which the legislature quite clearly limited only to employees, appointed officials, or employing governmental entities.
Okay, but you agree that they still can be sued. I understand your point, which is one is who does the Whistleblower Act apply to, and the other one who would be able to be personally liable as a supervisor, whether they were, you know, part of the Whistleblowing Act or not, correct?
I agree that those are two different inquiries, and I agree that the immunity waiver scope stands on its own and is different because it doesn't speak in individual terms. It has two categories of individuals, whereas this $15,000 sanction later speaks about any supervisor and uses words like any individual to mean natural persons. So those two things are different, I agree. Whether or not that means that a person, that for example, an elected official could be amenable to suit as opposed to that would be part of the court's remedy, no, I don't agree with that. It appears to me that only the entity itself can be sued, but that doesn't mean that, I believe it's 8.008, that 0.008 allows for a cause of action against the Attorney General.
Well, and then let's go to your point, which is only the entity can be sued. Isn't that what the plaintiffs have done in this case, sued the entity?
Well, yes, Your Honor, they sued the entity, but the question for the immunity waiver's purposes is about whom the reports are being made, whether the reports of misconduct are about an employee, an appointed official, or the body itself. Plainly, the gravamen of plaintiff's petition is that they allege a variety of acts that they believe amounted to misconduct by the Attorney General. Those certainly are a report, but they're not a report about an employee, an appointed officer, or the employing governmental entity. So I'm happy to agree they sued the office of the Attorney General. What their petition lacks is claims that the office of the Attorney General was the subject of reports, the actor of misconduct, etc., because plainly all of their, the gravamen of all of their claims is about the Attorney General and not the office.
But would you agree or disagree, either way, that Ken Paxton has the last word on decisions that come out of the Attorney General's office?
Certainly, Attorney General Paxton is the elected constitutional officer, and he has the both right and power to be able to make decisions on behalf of the agency. Nonetheless, that doesn't change the scope of the immunity waiver that the legislature carefully reticulated when it said a report must be about the agency itself.
Well, aren't his actions the actions of the agency? If he can change any decision internally that the Attorney General makes, if he could go in and say, nope, this pleading, I want it written this way, nope, I want this opinion letter this way, if he truly has that power to have the last say on anything that comes out of the agency, how is he not the agency?
Well, Your Honor, that argument proves sort of too much and too little at the same time. First, Texas law recognizes that the Attorney General and the Office of the Attorney General are two different entities. Let me give you a timely example. The 2020-21 budget, issued as enacted into law by the legislature, assigns approximately $1.3 billion to, in these terms, the Office of the Attorney General. It ascribes certain particular responsibilities to divisions within the Office of the Attorney General. And then separately, it tasks the Attorney General with, I believe, him or his designee sitting on an executive steering board.
But under that same, if we're going to talk about budgeting and how people are paid, I mean, doesn't that go against you on this other public employee side that he's in the employer's retirement system, he has a personnel file that shows his date of employment with the agency, you know, all those other bells and, you know, all those other trappings that the plaintiffs put in their original petition?
I'm happy to address those, Your Honor. The first point I'm making here is that they are separate people and that Texas law recognizes they're separate legal persons. Speaking about the sort of whether or not he's an employee, there are several reasons. First of all, employee is a term of art at common law that means an individual, an agent who answers to a principal who's also subject to that principal's method of control over how he performs his work. The Whistleblower Act indeed tracks the principal agent and employee independent contractor concept as it excludes independent contractors from the Whistleblower Act's coverage. The Attorney General, not just this Attorney General, but any elected official, is not an agent of anyone. He is a principal. There is no individual who is entitled to essentially order him as to how he performs his duties. And so he's not an agent, he's not an employee in the common law sense. And typically when the legislature uses a common law term of art, they bring up that common law soil with them. Speaking a little more directly,
isn't he an agent of the state of Texas? that the voters chose. So in essence, they are in charge of who gets to be in that position. So he does report to someone.
He certainly reports to the voters, Your Honor, and I don't obviously mean to imply otherwise, but that's not the same as a principal agency relationship. And at a minimum, you know, if we want to sort of be metaphysical here and think about there being a principal agency relationship in election, an employee is not merely an agent of a principal. An employee is someone who the methods of how they perform the acts in their employment are subject to direct control by a principal. And there certainly is no one who's entitled to sort of tell the Attorney General how he must perform his official duties in office. Also, again, this court's cases clearly delineate between an employee and an officer on each side. An employee must be supervised in some meaningful way by someone before the employee can take an act that would be associated with exercising the sovereignty of the state. An officer does not. And as you point out, Your Honor, the Attorney General, to the extent that he decides to involve himself in a decision or to make a decision, is not supervised by anyone else, for he is the final constitutional elected official entitled to represent the state of Texas. So he can't possibly be an employee in either the common law sense or in the employee officer sense that this court has provided. Now, there are a couple of, again, documents that my friends on the other side point to, including, for example, pay stubs and so on. One of them is the retirement system. I can tell you that the Attorney General participates as an elected official in that. But again, paperwork by the comptroller, sort of shorthand paperwork internally, can't change the constitutional status as between employee and officer of the Attorney General.
And thank you, Mr. Stone. We'll hear from you in rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, absolutely. And now we'll hear from the appellees. Mr. Knight.
May it please the court.
Absolutely.
The dual purposes of the Texas Whistleblower Act have been undisputed for decades now, and this court has recognized them many times. They are to protect public employees who inform proper authorities of wrongdoing and to secure compliance with the law by those who conduct governmental affairs. And as was just confirmed for you here, the Attorney General's office is here today asking not for any kind of a narrow exception, a narrow unwritten exception to this rule, but for a gaping exception that's never been recognized before in the three decades this law has been on the books that would exempt from the act the apex public officials at every level of government, thousands of them who conduct our affairs throughout the state. We're going to ask the court to reject that dangerous argument and just evaluate our pleading, because we're at that stage, by the same rules that it evaluates every other whistleblower claim. What I'd like to do is I'd like to start with three real quick points that are sort of standard of review type framing points that won't take long, and then dive into those substantive issues.
And as you do that, counsel, I assume you're going to explain to us, I know this went as a 91A motion in the trial court, but we're talking about immunity and sovereign immunity. It sounds like a plea to the jurisdiction to me. And I'd like to hear from you whether it's one, the other, or both at the same time.
Absolutely. And that is actually just about where I was planning to start. The attorney, by asking for the court to apply a presumption of immunity, the Office of the Attorney General here is inviting the court to apply the wrong standard. Here, we don't have to analyze the scope of the waiver of sovereign immunity. It's statutory. It's express in the Whistleblower Act. And everybody agrees that the scope of the immunity waiver is coterminous with liability under the statute. So the only question is whether we have pleaded a cause of action within the parameters of the statute. And when the court addresses that issue, the presumptions are actually precisely the opposite of what they say. The court looks to the pleader's intent and construes the pleadings liberally in favor of the plaintiffs to determine whether it stated a cause of action. Next point to yours, just Chief Justice Byrne, is the Attorney General elected to bring its jurisdictional challenge under Rule 91A because they wanted to avoid our early efforts to take discovery. And that's fine, but one of the things that comes with Rule 91A is another presumption in favor of the plaintiffs under the express terms of the rule. The court takes all of the facts alleged in our amended pleading as true and draws all reasonable inferences in favor of the plaintiffs. And then on top of that, the OAG has misstated the substantive standard of what we have to plead. They said in their brief, they didn't repeat it today because I don't think they got to it, but they said in their brief that we have to plead an actual violation of the law by a relevant person or entity. The law, according to the Supreme Court, is precisely the opposite. And in fact, the Supreme Court used the same terms in articulating the law the opposite way. In the City of Elsa case, the Supreme Court said, an actual violation of the law is not required under the Whistleblower Act. The Act requires only a good faith belief that a violation of the law has occurred. And so when you put all that together, given where we are in this super early stage of the case, the bar we have to clear is pretty low. The presumption's cut in our favor, and I think we cleared it by a mile. Now, to make sure I don't know if that addressed enough what you were asking about, Judge Byrne, but I'll jump quickly to the point on which the Rule 91A distinction is perhaps relevant in the briefing. They've tried to tell the court that after the argument on the plea to on the jurisdictional challenge, the Rule 91 motion, the trial court commenced a hearing on our request for a temporary injunction. That hearing never got completed. We got through one witness and started a second before the hearing was aborted. And they've tried to tell the court that the first witness we called, a non-party, Jeff Mateer, gave away our whole case. They say he testified that what he and the other whistleblowers witnessed was not a crime. It was at most the potential for that crime might occur in the future. And what we've said is, hey, you shouldn't even consider that, because it's a Rule 91 motion, because they did everything they could to prevent us from concluding that hearing to where the court could have weighed all of the evidence. There was an exchange, if you read the transcript of the argument on the Rule 91 hearing, where the trial judge asked me and the other lawyers, do you concede that I've got to decide this solely on the pleadings and without considering any evidence? We said, yes, we absolutely concede that, and we're prepared to have our pleadings measured by those rules. So I don't think the court should consider Mr. Mateer's testimony, but it also doesn't matter because they have so badly mischaracterized it for this court. They took a soundbite during an argument section of the hearing where he it couldn't be more clear that the judge said to Mr. Mateer, look, you've been threatened by the Attorney General's office that they might take legal action against you if you disclose something that you shouldn't disclose. So I'm going to let you, if I'm trying to determine the parameters of the privilege waiver here, I'm going to let you represent yourself as a lawyer if you want to. And in the course of the discussion, he says, Your Honor, I'd like to say something as a lawyer, not a witness. And that's where the soundbite that they rely on came in. But if you look later in the transcript, in the sections that we cited, we asked him directly, what was the basis for complaining to law enforcement about the things that concern you? And he said, the signatories on that letter, the letter that's in evidence, which includes all of the plaintiffs here, had a good faith belief that the Attorney General was violating federal and or state law, including prohibitions relating to improper influence, abuse of office, bribery, and other potential crimes. And then we asked him 2 pages later, and did you believe that when you signed the letter? He said, yes. And then we said, and do you stand by it today? And he said, yes. So the bottom line, Your Honor, is it doesn't really matter whether you consider Mr. Mateer's testimony or not. It's 100% consistent with our claims and with what we've alleged in the pleading. But I think technically, because it is a Rule 91 motion, that testimony is irrelevant.
And Mr. Knight, can you address the AG's argument that even though your clients have sued the AG, that the gravamen of your claims are based on Mr. Paxton's alleged criminal or bad acts as alleged in your second amended petition, and that because he is not a employee or an appointed official, as 554.002 kind of tie in your suit against the entity, that you're out of luck. How do you address that on behalf of the appellees?
Absolutely, absolutely. There is this concept under the Act of a relative entity or a relevant entity or person. And the Act identifies 3 categories of those things. It is the employing governmental entity, so OAG, or an employee, or an appointed official. We acknowledge he's not an appointed official, but we allege he is both Mr. Paxton is both, for purposes of this case, the employing governmental, let me say it better. We argue that we alleged unlawful conduct by both the Office of the Attorney General as the appointing governmental entity and by Mr. Paxton as a public employee and an employee. Now, we only have to go one for two on those to survive the motion to dismiss. We've alleged both. They have to be right on both to win. We have to be right on at least one. Let me address them in turn. I think the easy one, because it actually has precedent, is that the conduct we have complained about, that yes, Mr. Paxton did direct and control and participate in, was the conduct of the entity. Justice Kelly, as you pointed out, the OAG is an inanimate object. It can't act just like a corporation can't act, other than through its human beings who represented it. You know, and every act that we've complained about here is an act that Mr. Paxton took in his official capacity as the leader of the agency. You know, we're not complaining about something that Mr. Paxton did on his own time in the privacy of his own home. I mean, that might present a different analysis, at least under this prong of the statute. But when you look at the things that we're complaining about, they are things that he could not do on his own, that he could do and did do only by directing and forcing and requiring his agency to do them. And we cited, I think, three cases that have addressed this very issue. And it's 3-0, because they don't have any going the other way. It's the Rangel case, the Hart case that this court actually decided, and the Bivens case, and all three of them.
Mr. Knight, in those cases, did anyone, though, claim that the whistleblower act didn't apply to them? I mean, didn't they just go with it, and the case went forward from there?
Well, I think they did claim that. Certainly, that was in the two sheriff cases, which are elected confidential constitutional officers like the Attorney General, Bivens and Hart. The argument was, well, even if the sheriff participated in this conduct, the county shouldn't be liable for it. And this court's holding in Hart and the Fort Worth court's holding in Bivens was that when the sheriff acts in his official capacity, he is the county. He is a part of county government, and the county is responsible for those acts. And I think that's the same analysis here. And in a way, you know, they're, like I said, they have to go two for two, right? So they have the harder position. They're dancing on each side. And in a way, one of the arguments they make on employee makes our case on entity. They say that Ken Paxton, as the elected attorney general, exercises the authority of the sovereign. Well, if that's the case, the sovereign is responsible when he makes it do something illegal. That's what the whole point of the Whistleblower Act, saying that you can allege conduct of the employing governmental entity. So again, with no contrary authority, I think that's the easy way and the cleanest way to decide the case. However, the court could also very correctly determine that Mr. Paxton is a public employee. Let me say it this way. The Act defines public employee by beginning with the simple concept of employee. An employee paid to perform work for a governmental entity. In every ordinary sense, and the statute doesn't define that term employee any further. In every ordinary sense, Mr. Paxton is an employee. Just like the members of this court are employees of the state, and all of the other thousands of elected officers are employees of the state, and we went over those already. But here's what I'd like the court to focus on: the alternative that you have been presented with by the Attorney General's office is this: when the legislature got together and said we're going to draft this statute, one of the primary purposes of which is to make sure we secure compliance with the law by those who control governmental affairs. But we're going to exempt thousands of government, of apex employees who do in fact conduct government affairs. We're going to make sure an elected official can fire with impunity any subordinate who has the audacity to report his or her unlawful activity. And to draft that exception into this act, we're not going to use the word elected official. We're not going to draft the exception expressly. We're going to hide it in the definition of public employee by saying, in addition to all employees who work for the state being public employees, also appointed officers are employees. That way, all of our elected officers will be exempt. I mean, that is such a strained and unlikely construction of the statute. And I thought one of the most colorful phrases that came out of our the court down the hall this year was in the Hogan opinion, and we quoted it, where the court said, the legislature does not hide elephants in mouse holes. They're asking you to find the biggest elephant, the biggest exception to this statute, in the smallest mouse hole that there is.
Mr. Knight, do you have any precedent or any other? I know the cases that you have cited are the county trying to get out of liability for an elected official's acts. Do you have any cases where elected officials themselves have been sued as a whistleblower under the Whistleblower Act?
No, Your Honor, I don't have that, and I don't think we could sue the elected official personally. The Whistleblower Act, as I read it, requires the lawsuit to be against the employing entity.
Under the supervisor, well, I guess maybe you can explain to me what the purpose of .008 is. I understand that it's to limit liability to the $15,000. So who gets sued under that?
I don't know if we would have to name the supervisor as an additional defendant in order to seek the penalty against the supervisor. I should know the answer to that question, Your Honor, and I'm sorry I don't. But I do know this. The employer of my client and the other appellees here today was the Office of the Attorney General, the state agency, and that's the entity that fired them unlawfully. And so the office is the appropriate defendant in the lawsuit. Could we have named Mr. Paxton as an additional defendant and sought the relatively nominal additional penalties against him? Maybe so, but the key is that the agency is responsible for actions that he takes in his official capacity.
And my reading of .008 is that the individual that gets to sue the supervisor is the OAG gets to sue, or a district attorney,
that
not
is,
you as an appellee.
That sounds right. Now that I think that is right, Your Honor.
And I doubt the OAG would sue Mr. Paxton in this instance for the $15,000, even if these allegations were true.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'd like to add one more thing on this statutory construction issue, because they try to belittle our argument a little bit by relying on the purpose of the statute as if that is somehow something the court shouldn't consider. But in the Code Construction Act, 311.023, the legislature has told the court, in construing a statute, whether or not the statute is considered ambiguous on its face, a court may consider several things, and among them are the object sought to be attained and the consequences of a particular construction. And I think if the court follows that directive from the legislature and construes this Whistleblower Act with those thoughts in mind, it is impossible to reach the conclusion that the legislature intended to exempt this conduct from whistleblower liability and to exempt thousands of other elected officers entirely from liability under the Act. I might finish a minute or two early if the court doesn't have any other questions. I would wrap.
What about their argument in their pleadings about adequate report to law enforcement? There was something in the OAG's argument that the appellees did not make the appropriate report to an appropriate law enforcement officer.
I think they tried to muddy the waters a little bit. I mean, these are the undisputed facts, right? On September the 30th, three of the four plaintiffs in the case went to the FBI and met with the FBI for several hours and laid out what they believed in good faith to be violations of the law. On the same day, the fourth appellee, Mr. Maxwell, met with the Texas Rangers. I don't think there's any credible argument that the FBI and the Texas Rangers are not appropriate law enforcement authorities to take the test, these concerns to, this good faith belief of a violation of law. Where they tried to muddy the waters is the day after that, on October 1st, these guys came back to the office and they wanted to protect themselves. They could see what was going to happen, right? They wanted to protect themselves from the attorney general or somebody else saying, well, gee, I didn't know you guys reported anything to law enforcement. When I fired you because you've been a terrible employee all these years that I've given you great performance reviews. They were worried about that. And so they sent a letter to HR that said, hey, just so you know, we went to the FBI and the Texas Rangers yesterday and we reported what we believe to be good faith, in good faith violations of law by the attorney general. So we claim the status of whistleblowers. And they've tried to muddy the waters in their briefs a little bit by saying, well, that report to the HR department in the AG's office, that's not a report to appropriate law enforcement authorities. Well, we never claimed that it was. Our report to the FBI and to the Texas Rangers, and then later to the Travis County District Attorney's Office, was our report to appropriate law enforcement authorities. The other thing that you might be referring to, Judge, that I'll just hit equally quickly, is the notion that the court should look to the Federal False Claims Act and say, well, there can't be one more than one whistleblower, that you've got a bunch of copycats here. Well, number one, there's no provision in the Texas Whistleblower Act that limits it to one or to somebody with unique facts or anything like that. But number two, that doesn't even fit the timeline. It's not like one of them went to the FBI in September and then somebody else came by 2 months later and reported the same thing. They figured it out together and they went to law enforcement together. And the one guy who was out of town went to a different law enforcement agency on the same day. So this notion that we didn't report it or it wasn't viable, I don't think passes muster. Maybe I could give, with 10 seconds, I could close this way. This court decided a whistleblower case 15 years ago that's cited a lot, the Texas Department of Assistant Rehab Services versus Howard. And the opening two lines of the opinion were these. The state of Texas elevates public employees who report legal wrongdoing to a protected status as a matter of fundamental policy. The state views whistleblowing by a public employee as a courageous act of loyalty to a larger community, and we allow whistleblowing public employees to be made whole through lawsuits against the state. That sums it up why we're here and why we ask the court to affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Knight and Mr. Stone. We look forward to your rebuttals. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
Since my friend on the other side concluded with a quote from this court regarding the purposes of the Whistleblower Act, I suppose I'll start with a quote from the Texas Supreme Court regarding the purposes of the Whistleblower Act. That court has rejected in the last, since 2018, has rejected at least four times an appeal to a universal whistleblower tort or something on that order, most recently in Neighborhood Services Center versus Walker, where it described directly that the law of whistleblowing reflects two important interests in tension with one another between the continued and efficient provision of public services and protecting individuals who report violations of law. Of course, in the terms of the Texas Supreme Court, that leads to a law that is, quote, far from universal in its scope. My friends on the other side and I apparently agree that the threshold and dispositive question here is whether or not the Attorney General is either the employing governmental entity, or an employee. Well, as we discussed earlier, Justice Kelly, he's not an employee for a variety of reasons, including, for example, that he doesn't have a principal to whom he reports, no one is entitled, in fact, to supervise how he performs his duties, and as this court has distinguished between officers and employees, he's plainly entitled to exercise sovereign functions without further supervision,
So he's an officer and not an employee, as again this court has described them as two mutually exclusive categories. Nor is he the entity, the office of the Attorney General. As I had mentioned prior, the legislature in numerous places has acknowledged the office of the Attorney General is different from the Attorney General himself for a variety of reasons. My friend on the other side may reference, for example, to a corporate body or a corporate institution. I think, unfortunately, that comparison cuts against him and not for him. Because if the CEO of an institution were to direct a corporation to, for example, enter into contract with someone, you know, with a rival firm, and then later the corporation is unable to perform, the CEO isn't going to be named in the breach of contract action. It's the corporation that will be. The corporation will own the rights to the contract and will have to shoulder the burdens. So to the extent that my friend was using that sort of corporate analogy, I think that separate legal person is precisely what we're getting at here. And indeed, the act itself offers a description of what a state governmental entity is. There's three subparts. The first one describes boards, commissions, offices, legally incorporated things of that nature. The second involves the legislature and legislative creations. And the third is the Texas Supreme Court, this court, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Again, legally created entities. None of those subsections, would you imagine a natural person fitting within any of them?
Mr. Stone, how does the Attorney General's interpretation of this Whistleblower Act in any way further the act? Further the purposes of the act, and if I'm understanding you correctly, it's any employee at the Attorney General's office could make the office of the Attorney General liable under the Whistleblower Act, or any person who works in that building, except Ken Paxton.
That's not quite our position, Your Honor. It's that wrongful actions that are taken by employees or appointed officials, reports of those would fall within the waiver. Of course, you could have a report about the entity itself. My contracting example is what I mean by that. Such a claim would be against the employee and the appointed officer. But to speak to your purpose question directly, as the Supreme Court noted as recently as its Facebook case from earlier this year, and noted the way that we know the legislature's purposes is by the lines that it draws, the text that it imbues, the text that it creates the act out of. The legislature, in its judgment, decided, when deciding how far to extend whistleblower protections, decided that reports made about employees and appointed officers and entities on the one hand would be protected by the act, but not elected officials. And every elected official immediately understands the distinction. Elected officials are subject to a variety of checks, a variety of forms of public responsibility that no one else is. Of course, for example, your honors are not employees in any meaningful sense, as their argument would require us to construe you as, but you're very well aware that what you do, you're accountable to voters, that the legislature can ask you to testify on one or a number of matters, and you ultimately are going to have the public judge the rightness of your actions. So with the Attorney General, that is the ultimate check, so to speak, on any allegations of misconduct and the ultimate verdict on them. So to the extent that we're discussing the purposes of the act and why the legislature might have drawn that distinction is because every single member of the legislature feels keenly the obligations that are unique to elected officials. All that's been denied here is a judicial forum under this narrow waiver of sovereign immunity, nothing more.
Thank you so much, counsel.
Thank you.
Appreciate both sides' arguments today. This case will be submitted, and this court stands in recess. Thank you very much.